Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a Dhamma talk on the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta. This sutta is a teaching on right view and also a clear explanation of the common misunderstandings of emptiness and non-duality. This talk includes Sangha Q&A and discussion and was recorded at Cross River Meditation Center in Frenchtown, New Jersey on November 15, 2016. This talk concludes with meta-intentional meditation. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation. Thank you. Peace. So tonight's talk is on the Kakaya Yanagata Sutta, Sutta on Right View. If there's any questions while I'm reading it, please just let me know, and then we'll have a discussion afterwards. I've been going back and forth all day and probably since last week about saying anything about last week's election. I've been getting a lot of emails and calls, and what do you think? And perhaps the discussion will develop something about that. But really all I want to say is that the politics of the United States, as they are of the whole world, are part of the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth says that there will be disappointing things that happen in our lives. And the Second Noble Truth says the craving for and clinging to the idea that something should be different than what occurs creates more upset and disturbances in our minds. It's the second arrow. So the right view, which is what we'll talk about tonight, is to simply see it that way. Whether we agree with who won or not, having an extreme reaction is part of that second noble truth, and it shows us that we're not seeing this situation clearly within right view. And if somebody wants to talk more about this during a discussion, we can. And beyond that, we need to remember that we have one of the—it's not a perfect system, but we have one of the few systems on the planet that at least has some reflection in the Eightfold Path, meaning that it allows for structured change. And it acknowledges impermanence. In other words, if you're not happy, we only got to deal with it for 4 years. and if you, the other part of that, and that this has came up today with a few people. If you happen to be very pleased with the election, which many, many people are in this country, understand that there's many, many people that are upset and they're full of fear. And what does the Eightfold Path tell us about that? To understand that because we felt it ourselves. And to be compassionate. And that's really the only thing we can do about it. If we've participated in the system has spoken. And the only thing we can do in the future is to remain well concentrated and framed by the Eightfold Path, and then we can respond appropriately. So, and again, if anybody wants to talk more about that, that's fine. And you'll see where the sutta actually speaks to that, but that's not why I chose it for this week's talk. The Kakaya Yanagata Sutta is a teaching on right view and also a clear explanation of the common misunderstandings of emptiness and non-duality. And the sutta that I reference, the translation was Thanissara Bhikkhu's, who uses the word polarity as opposed to using the words dual or non-dual to describe what's occurring in this sutta. And the reason why that's important is polarity speaks to this specific topic of what the Buddha is explaining, rather than using the words dual or non-dual, which is a fixated view, meaning that everything is either dualistic or it's non-dualistic, and that we should reconcile everything into this non-dual view, which is just contradictory to everything the Buddha taught. The insistence on a non-dual doctrine obscures reality and contradicts right view and the entire Eightfold Path. As seen here, the Buddha shows that a non-dual doctrine is an extreme or wrong view, rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. The simple teachings on dependent origination are used by the Buddha to show what is meant by the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. Notice that there is nothing in the direct teachings of dependent origination that would imply a doctrine of interdependence, interconnectedness, or interbeing, as these are non-dual teachings. In the sutta, the world is a metaphor, the word world, is a metaphor for confused and deluded views that result in unsatisfactory experiences. So the sutta is a is a talk the Buddha is giving directly to Kakaya Nagata, who obviously has a understanding of the Eightfold Path well enough to understand that his views are still confused. He's asking for clarification on right view, which means that his confusion is saying, maybe I don't have this. And that's a skillful place to be, and the Buddha also recognizes that. He's not missing something, he just needs to have his view attuned to be more in line with the Eightfold Path. So the Buddha was staying at Sabati, at Jita's Grove, Anathapindika's monastery. The monk, Kakaya Nagata, approached the Buddha with a question. I don't understand right view. Can you teach me how right view relates to the world? Kakayana, the confusion and deluded thinking in the world arises from polarizing views. There is the view of permanent existence and a view of permanent non-existence. When the origination of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that non-existence does not occur. Furthermore, when the cessation of confused and deluded thinking is understood and abandoned, from right view it is seen that existence does not occur, meaning a fixed existence or a fixed non-existence. The world is sustained by attachments, by clinging to conditioned thinking and wrong views rooted in ignorance of Four Noble Truths. One who has developed right view no longer clings to attachments or fixated thinking. Another word for fixated thinking is conditioned thinking. Or self-obsession. It is understood that stress arising is simply stress arising. It is understood that stress passing away is simply stress passing away. In this, their knowledge is independent of other views. So he's recognizing that Kakaya Nagata's views, the way he's expressing them now, are influenced by his conditioned thinking rooted in other views. His thinking has not yet established its own independence. Is that clear? That's an important line in the sutta.
Could you repeat that, please?
What I just said or what I just read?
Well, what you're asking us to.
Okay, let me read it again.
Whether we understand or not.
In this, their knowledge is independent of other views. So he's recognizing that the monk in question, part of his confusion is arising because his conditioned thinking has been influenced by other views. So he's trying to point out to Kakaya Nagata to look at your conditioning and begin to separate it from the other views that you once believed in, which is a very difficult thing for many of us to do, to become independent of your thinking. So even during the Buddha's time, and despite the lack of global communications, meaning influence from all corners of the globe, there was still a difficulty arising in the monks and nuns of the Buddha Sangha to remain independent of the outside influences. And all that he's pointing to is to recognize how those are creating polarizing views in your mind. Is that clear, Andrew?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And as we develop our own understanding and start, as our concentration deepens and we use the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path in the way it's intended, we're able to actually see where our conditioning comes from and where our views may not be independent. We're still clinging to old views that no longer fit into this Eightfold Path.
And those views are generating more views that are confused.
Yeah, that leads directly to Kakaya Yana's initial question. Can you tell me how right view relates to the world? One way that it relates to the world is to recognize that at present your views may not be independent. And I think that'll become more clear as this develops and as this relates to dependent origination. One of the interesting things about this sutta, it's another sutta where the Buddha teaches dependent origination in a very specific way as it relates, and you'll see how this develops, as it relates directly to the Four Noble Truths. The Buddha continues. The view that everything exists is a wrong view, and the view that nothing exists is another wrong view. My Dhamma avoids extreme views. I teach from the middle. I teach the Eightfold Path as the middle way that avoids extreme views. And the Buddha continues. The middle way shows that, and this is dependent origination. Excuse me. The middle way shows that from ignorance of Four Noble Truths, As a requisite condition comes fabrications. So fabrications are conditioned thought constructs. Another simpler word is assumptions. Because of what's occurred to us through an ignorant view, we've created assumptions about the world. And it's those assumptions or fabrications that then lead to the rest of dependent origination causing stress and confusion in our minds. From fabrications as a requisite condition comes consciousness. And again, I always qualify that. It's not consciousness with a big C. It's not a grand, all-encompassing consciousness. Using the word consciousness in this setting relates back to ignorance. It's consciousness that is rooted in ignorance. So it's an ongoing thought process that is rooted in ignorance. And since it's rooted in ignorance, it cannot develop wisdom. Something has to take place. Another aspect of ignorance, and it's probably one of the most important applications of using the word ignorance, is ignore. And a mind that is ignorant of something is prone to ignore anything that would end its ignorance. So we are prone to ignore the simple truths that are contained in the Four Noble Truths. We don't want to see it, even though it's right in front of us. Is that clear? And that's part of that recognizing independent or interdependent thinking. From consciousness as a requisite condition comes name and form. That means we start identifying ourselves as this. From name and form as a requisite condition comes the sixth sense base. From the sixth sense base as a requisite condition comes contact. In other words, we need to have physical senses and that sixth sense of intellect to interact with the world. Contact takes place. And if our reference for that contact is rooted in ignorance, what follows is, from contact as a requisite condition comes feeling. From feeling as a requisite condition comes craving. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. So using the election as just an example, something occurs. It interrupted with our craving for a certain outcome. I'm talking about those that are upset of the outcome. And because we're clinging to the view that something should be the way it is and it's not what occurs, we are now upset. Disappointment has occurred related to that craving and clinging. From craving as a requisite condition comes clinging and maintaining. From clinging and maintaining as a requisite condition comes becoming. From becoming as a requisite condition comes birth. From birth as a requisite condition comes aging, sickness, death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair. Such is the origination of extreme views and the entire mass of confusion, delusion, and stress. The entire mass of confused and extreme views is rooted in ignorance. So how do we end extreme views and the effect that it has on us as individuals? We develop wisdom. So now, the Buddha's teaching Kakaya Yanagata, from the remainderless fading and cessation away of that very ignorance comes the cessation of fabrications, comes the cessation of assumptions. We're now seeing things clearly. From the cessation of fabrications comes the cessation of consciousness, ongoing thought processes rooted in ignorance. From the cessation of consciousness comes the cessation of name and form. From the cessation of name and form comes the cessation of the sixth sense media, the sixth sense base. From the cessation of the sixth sense base comes the cessation of contact. From the cessation of contact comes the cessation of feeling. From the cessation of feeling comes the cessation of craving. From the cessation of craving comes the cessation of clinging and sustenance, or maintaining. From the cessation of clinging and maintaining comes the cessation of becoming. From the cessation of becoming comes the cessation of birth. From the cessation of birth, then aging and death, sorrow, regret, pain, distress, and despair all cease. And that doesn't mean that, and again, the misapplication of these teachings has led to the understanding, or the belief, it's not an understanding, that when we fully develop the Dhamma, consciousness ceases. It's only consciousness that's rooted in ignorance that ceases. Ongoing thinking that is rooted in reality continues. And we no longer give birth to a life that is prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. Sickness, aging, and death continue, but we no longer react to it. We understand it. It's simply part of life. We accept it because that's what's occurring. again, as I talk about awakening, relates to really a full human maturity. That's a mature view, isn't it? We simply accept things that occur. And then we're able to take mindful actions that are in accordance with the Eightfold Path and will not lead to more confusion, delusion, or stressful moments. So the Buddha concludes, with such is the cessation of this entire mass of stress and suffering, by understanding that. Remember, the question began with, how does right view relate to the world? Right view relates to the world by seeing the results of ignorance. And what does that motivate one to do? To end ignorance. How do I end ignorance? Develop the Eightfold Path. The Buddha awakened to dependent origination, and the very first teaching he gave to that understanding of ignorance is the Four Noble Truths. And then everything he taught for the next 45 years was in the context of that Four Noble Truths, including this sutta. So let me go on a little bit further. That's the end of the sutta. When developed and fully integrated, the Eightfold Path shows that fixed views are also views that fix a self within fixed views. Is that clear? I know. And so what it points to, and the reason why I wrote it that way, is to show very clearly how we encapsulate ourselves in our fixed view, and then everything we see is a self-referential view. Another way of saying that is our conditioned thinking is discursive thinking. And we start bouncing our thoughts against our views, and they come back to us, and it makes us more and more confused. That's what happened to Kakai Yanagata. He was developing the Dhamma to a certain point, but he was still stuck in some of his old conditioned views. And he did not understand clearly how that related to the original ignorance. And the Buddha showed him by describing dependent origination again and reminding him that it's an Eightfold Path that ends ignorance. Let me continue a little bit more. The Buddha's teachings bring understanding and release from fixed views and develops the understanding of the potential of each moment to incline mindfulness towards awakening or towards full human maturity. Each moment holds the potential to cease becoming rooted in ignorance and develop the requisite conditions through the Eightfold Path to become free of all ignorant views and live a life from right view. Let me just go on and just go over the first teaching on the Four Noble Truths. And there's Samyutta Nikaya, the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta, the sutta setting the wheel of the Dhamma in motion. The Buddha's very first teaching, he presented the middle way of the Eightfold Path. In this sutta, the Buddha refers to the extreme views of existence and non-existence as a compulsion to engage in constant sensory stimulation or clinging to existence or the existential experience, and the asceticism of denial or manipulated non-existence, which is still practiced in some form today, and it's what the Buddha tried to develop when he was practicing his ascetic practice. In other words, he was trying to establish a physical way of living non-existence while existing. And eventually he came to realize the absurdity of even that. But that was a common practice back then, and it's still practiced today. These are the Buddha's words from the Dhammacakkappavattana Sutta. There are these two extreme views that are not to be indulged in by one who has gone forth. Which two? That which is devoted to sensual pleasure with reference to sensual objects, its base, vulgar, common, ignoble, unprofitable, and that which is devoted to self-affliction, painful, ignoble, and unprofitable as well. Avoiding both of these extremes, the middle way realized by the Tathagata, meaning himself, producing vision, producing knowledge leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding. And what is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that produces vision, produces knowledge, and leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, to unbinding? Precisely this Noble Eightfold Path. Right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, right concentration. This is the middle way realized by the Tathagata that leads to calm, to direct knowledge, to self-awakening, and to unbinding. Now this, monks, is the noble truth of stress. I'm sorry. Oh, I lost my page. Birth is stressful, aging is stressful, death is stressful, sorrow, regret, pain and distress, and despair are stressful. Association with the unbeloved is stressful. Separation from the loved is stressful. Not getting what is wanted is stressful. In short, the five clinging aggregates are stressful, meaning our views of ourselves. And this, monks, is the noble truth of the origination of stress. The craving that makes for further becoming, accompanied by passion and delight, relishing now, here, and now, there. And it, for example, craving for sensual pleasure, craving for becoming, and craving for non-becoming. And this is a noble truth of the cessation of stress, the remainderless fading and cessation, renunciation, relinquishment, and letting go of that very craving. This is the noble truth of the way of practice leading to the cessation of stress, precisely this noble eightfold path. So again, the Buddha brings everything back to those original teachings. The first factor of the eightfold path is right view. So initially that right view is the acceptance that I don't understand the nature of the world around me and how I relate. And we can tell that because of our own confusion and unsatisfactory experiences in life. That opens the door towards developing the entire Eightfold Path and developing profound right view. And the Buddha describes profound right view as understanding stress, abandoning craving and clinging, having the experience of the cessation of stress, and fully developing the Eightfold Path. That's right view. So again, everything points back to that. Did you have a question?
Yeah, well, it's not really a question. Maybe it's a comment.
Well, let's go around the room then and wait for the comment. I mean, you're welcome to do it now, but what's the comment?
I don't know. I could go around. It's just it's a short one, just on non-becoming, because I've heard that, you know, a million times about the craving for non-becoming, and I always interpreted it it just didn't land 100%, but I think now, I always thought it was kind of some kind of aversion, trying to get out, an annihilation, but I think finally understand that it's more this craving for the void kind of thing. Is that what? Craving for emptiness, you know, to escape this human kind of thing, right?
So that's a good question.
Bliss idea where people will say to me a lot, you know, because they know I meditate, oh, you know, you're going to go find your bliss. I'm like, that's not really what I'm trying to do. I'm trying to see how suffering arises so that I can let go of that process. Is that clear?
Yes. So the remembering in the context that the Buddha's using these words and teaching, becoming, means it's a becoming that's rooted in ignorance. So the only thing that can become, another word for that would be giving birth to. Only thing that can become, that we can give birth to out of ignorance, is another ignorant moment that's prone to confusion, delusion, and suffering. And it's rooted in a wrong desire. And one of those desires can be, and often is, the craving for non-existence, for nothingness.
Right. So that, not so much death non-existence, but
a mindless experience of life. Yes.
Yes. Yeah. That's what I'm trying to say. Because again, I've heard that saying, but
this is kind of all what Zen is pointing at, or wants to point at. This.
You said that. I didn't. Well, there's difficulties in the later developed schools, mostly. And again, they're all legitimate, but they're not based on, they contradict the Buddhist teachings, and it comes down to these ideas of duality and non-duality, and the idea of becoming, what are becoming. So when we understand the Buddhist teachings and what he's trying to develop, that word becoming is an important word to understand, and it points to the potential that each moment has. With the deep, well-concentrated mind that has developed a refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path, each moment holds the potential to develop or become more awakened, more fully mature. Continued ignorance, we can only become something that's rooted in ignorance. And so one view that the Buddha is talking about, an extreme view, is the view of non-existence, what Mora was talking about, which is a way of manipulating your thinking towards just escape and not true understanding. Nothing exists. I'm in the midst of nothingness. I don't have to be concerned about anything, do I then? And that can create a false measure of calm that you create another identity from.
And wasn't that what when the Buddha was in India, that people were trying to escape the experience of being in a human body?
So that was part of it.
They were trying to achieve through asceticism non-becoming.
Yes, the thought was that if you can deny yourself every human need, that that need itself will fall away. When what the Buddha found out is just the opposite,
so that's because
then the striving for nothingness becomes your own identity and creates its own problem. Mm-hmm. So using that as a point of reference, and the Buddha realized this. This is why he taught what he said was a middle way, because he experienced those two extremes of existence and non-existence, or complete sensory and sensual fulfillment and complete denial, and realize that they are both extreme views. And if they're an extreme view, it's an extreme view because we've established I-making as both of those views. I'm living a life, and so I deserve to have complete sensory indulgence. Kind of what we talked about last week about life as a banquet, don't leave the table hungry, rather than life as a banquet, take only what you need. That restraint. But we can take restraint to an extreme that points towards non-existence, which is just as confusing and deluding and prone to stress. There's a middle way. And so the Buddha taught a middle way that allows us, in fact, it insists that we recognize our humanity and live as awakened human beings, understanding the impermanent nature of all things. And if we start attaching ourselves as from permanent views as a permanent established human being, that's an extreme example of existence, isn't it? Rather than recognizing there's not existence and non-existence, there's simply an ongoing process of what Moira brought up, becoming. And so then the important question is, what am I going to become? What does this next moment hold for me? And how can I best develop a moment? How can I lay the foundation for the next moment in my life that's in accordance with the Dhamma? How? Through the framework of the Eightfold Path. I start learning to recognize where my conditioned views or assumptions are leading me, recognizing them, and simply abandon them. And the reason why I say simply abandon is don't analyze it, because there's no way of knowing ultimately where an assumption came from except to recognize that it comes from ignorance. Let it go. It cannot serve you. Yeah, and again, the Buddha's pointing to the usefulness of impermanence. You know, anicca, impermanence, doesn't only create difficulty, it allows us to change. If there wasn't such a thing as impermanence and ongoing becoming, we'd never be able to get out of this mess that we've created for ourselves. We'd just be stuck in this ongoing self-referential views rather than freeing ourselves through recognition and renunciation, through the refined mindfulness that's rooted in concentration. Is that clear? If not, please let me know. No.
It's not that I can't even formulate a question about
it. No. Let's see what maybe Frank's question will help Andrew.
I like to keep things simple. I think that we can claim to be coming. I like to just, I think everything right there that I need to know is the potential for liberation resides in each moment that occurs.
Yes.
Let it go.
Yeah, and that's really what the teachings are. What he's saying in a general way to everyone through the Dhamma. What is the most important thing to recognize? What's occurring right now? To not be concerned about how we got here and not be concerned about where we're going. What's occurring right now? And what's the most important thing? The most important thing is to have a well-concentrated mind that is viewing our interaction with the world through the refined mindfulness of the Eightfold Path.
That's simple.
I guess my question would be, if we're worried about becoming something, we already have become human. And if we're just supposed to live in the moment and experience life through our senses and not worried about becoming anything other than just here and now, then I don't really understand why we have to worry about becoming. Because the moment is passing. Why do I, isn't that the ego trying to establish itself or becoming something?
It's a good question, and it gets to the the only real usefulness of the ego. So from a conditioned point of view, the ego is running the show. From an awakened point of view, the ego is now simply a function of the mind. It's no longer running the show. We've gained control of our thinking. We're not stuck in mindlessness.
So my practice of meditation has allowed me to see thoughts arise, and there's a world out there beyond my thoughts and my mind that I don't even have to attach to. It's living in the now without worrying about thoughts. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, without getting caught up in self-referential thoughts.
Without even connecting to it.
Yep. Yeah, that's right, and it is very simple. Maura, what were you going to say?
Well, I was going to say that also the Buddha taught that all our senses are burning with desire. So it may be very simple, but I do, the deeper I practice, the more I feel like I can see that. You know, we have to be able to see the nature of our suffering. That's my feeling.
What do you mean the nature of it?
That you mentioned something in the talk, maybe, I think, about when you were just referring to the election and delusion. And truthfully, and I know I myself am included in this, I do not want to look at my suffering. I don't want to look at the pleasant aspects of my suffering, the unpleasant aspect. It's very easy to live in delusion. It's very lazy. We get pulled around this way and that way, and we have no independence. So I think, I guess when I, maybe I, that isn't the right word to look at the nature of our suffering, but I don't think it's, it is a simple framework, but I think that it goes deep.
Oh, yeah. Because it's the deepest teaching there is. So the, I mean, I didn't mean to put you on a spot by asking what do you mean by the nature of suffering, but just to clarify, the nature of suffering is part of the three marks of existence. There is suffering. That's the nature of it. Developing an understanding of our contributions to suffering is recognizing, abandoning, craving, and clinging. That's the value of understanding the nature of suffering. Suffering isn't something to be looked at individually.
I didn't say that's what you meant, Maura.
Wait, sorry, because
I used the total wrong word. What I was trying to get at is that just the Buddha said our senses are on fire. So I don't know that it's his teaching was to just live like in the now and that's all that there is to it. I think that we also need to kind of look really closely at what's happening. That's wisdom, right?
Well, yeah.
Not analyze what's happening. I don't mean to analyze.
Well, that's what you're talking about, right view.
You're
talking about right view then. And right view is the view that we develop that ultimately gets to the point where there's no more I-making left in our thinking and in our view. So, and again, pointing back to the simple but deep process of developing the Eightfold Path to recognize that.
I think that the nature of our suffering is rooted in ignorance.
Yep, dependent origination.
Of the Four Noble Truths. That's the nature of human suffering.
And so, again, getting back to this, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but getting back to this specific sutta, Kakaya Yanagata had an element of confusion about right view. How does it fit into the world? How do I relate right view to the world? And the Buddha taught him in a very simple way, dependent origination, and he told him to be wary of views that are clinging to the common beliefs of duality and non-duality, existence, non-existence, complete sensory indulgence, and asceticism. Those are extreme views. He's simply saying, develop a middle way of living your life through the Eightfold Path.
I found this, to come back to one of the original things you said, to speak on the selection thing, very helpful, because it exposes us to our deluded thinking. A lot of us went into this with some fairly deluded thinking, and we can use this happening to sit back and realize that our view was pretty well deluded. And we can go back and show to myself that this had to do with a nice chunk of eye making that was in there.
That's right.
And you know, you can keep digging in this, and there's a lot of the Eightfold Path right in there.
Exactly. And that's the right way to see it. You know, no matter whether we're disappointed or elated, look at the eye-making that was involved in all of this.
All the attachment to how things...
Yeah, and it's a great teaching on that, if we can develop a little calm about what's occurred. And again, I mean, on both sides, the people that are real happy that we have Mr. Trump as our next president, the ones that are very fearful. Those are extreme views in themselves. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't have them. They're understandable. But learn from it. Just like anything else. Gail.
So you're saying, you know, the middle way. So you're not saying don't have a view, right? You're just saying don't be so...
Well, ultimately, don't have a self-referential view.
But I'm not quite sure I get that. I think, you know, if you have a view on the election,
Well, calmness and being thrilled about something is two different things, isn't it? Acceptance and approval are two different things.
Right, but if you're... I don't quite get it in this context.
Let me bring it back to the context of the Four Noble Truths. The First Noble Truth states that, in a lot of different ways, it states that dukkha occurs. Dukkha meaning an unsatisfactory, disappointing nature in life. We create disturbances in our minds and in our experience through craving and clinging. So the self-referential view is, and I'll just use the example, is I can't believe that Hillary lost. And how could this, just to put the word in, how could this SOB, blah, blah, blah. Those are views that are rooted in craving and clinging.
Right.
Recognizing that is the important thing. It has nothing to do with who won. Again, this is an individual practice. Recognizing that my views have caused disturbance in my mind is an aspect of a lack of concentration and understanding. Rather than being someone who voted for Mrs. Clinton, and she lost, okay, this is the next moment, period. So just because you voted for someone doesn't necessarily mean you have a self-referential view. It simply means you're participating in a process.
Right, so you have a view, and you're going to go towards that view, and if it doesn't work out, you're not going to, you know, you're just going to go to the next step.
What? Yes. And the less you there is in the vote, the less agitation and disturbance there'll be in your mind. Your mind, pointing back to emptiness, your mind will be empty of disturbance, yet you've done the same thing as the person next to you who has a strong view that it has to be one way and is very upset.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm not saying that one view is right or wrong. What I'm pointing out...
But it almost sounds like you were saying don't have a view. Like, you're going to have a view, you just don't...
You don't
attach
yourself. Yes. So pointing back to the idea... Pointing back to the idea that the ego is simply a function of the mind rather than what's driving you, it's that function of the mind that allows you... Helen said it great a couple weeks ago. The ego as a function of the mind stops you from walking in the trees. That's perfect. Your ego gets you into the voting booth. a well-refined mind hopefully directs your vote, whether it's one or the other or all of them. You walk out of the booth and you find out that it went the other way. It went the other way, period. And again, just using that as an example, are people right to be protesting and doing all the things? I don't know if they're right or wrong. I understand it. I understand where it's coming from. And I see in most people a disturbed mind. Now, you could have a non-self-referential view that is broad enough to not have any disturbance, and you still feel the need to express that view in some way. That's okay.
Protesting or whatever.
Yeah.
And you can still...
But, yes, you the...
Hold the Dhamma in mind and protest the conditions of what happened.
Yes. So, this is that underlying question that many people have about the Dhamma when they misunderstand the complete ramifications of it. And it usually comes out with a question like that. You mean I can't have any views? Or the idea of annihilation. What happens when I let go of all self-referential views? Well, it happens to me. I'm gone. Well, the answer lies in the Dhamma and the example of the first one that did it. The Buddha awakened. He had a complete understanding of the nature of reality. He had a mind that was resting in equanimity for the last 45 years of his life. And yet he advised some of the most powerful rulers of his time. And he did that without a self-referential view. But there's stories in the Pali Canon where he's advising one king who's thinking of taking his army and destroying another kingdom. And he doesn't sit on a soapbox and say, you can't even think that way, you're wrong, you have a wrong view. But what he does is explain to that king, I wish I could think of his name, the results of his views one way or the other. In other words, if he could change his view to being compassionate and understanding the results of a war, then he might change the way that he approaches it. In other words, he's teaching the king the Eightfold Path. The king had a view, a self-referential view of, I'm the king, that kingdom is wrong, or I need it, and I'm gonna do anything I can, rather than developing the understanding that he does have a position of power, just like Mr. Trump will have a position of power. Develop the Dhamma and wield your power from that compassionate point of view. So I got a little bit further away from what you were asking. But so just to summarize it, the Buddha's not teaching, or the Dhamma doesn't teach us that we can have no views. What the Dhamma teaches is that it is our self-referential views and our insistence on things being a certain way that causes stress in our lives. And when we can accept the fact that the entire universe, including politics, including our next-door neighbor, are all part of an ongoing process. And sometimes that process will be satisfying, and sometimes it's going to be very unsatisfactory. And to recognize that process, to not lose our minds over it, to be able to maintain a mind of equanimity. Why? Because we've developed that broader view of impermanence in all things, including American politics.
Mm-hmm. So, can I make one short comment?
Sorry. Yes.
Just that leading up to the election, I can guarantee, and I myself absolutely can guarantee, that many of my thoughts were diluted. Diluted thoughts, attached thoughts, one piled on top of another, you know, willful ignorance to see things from a certain perspective, sometimes broadening that perspective and letting go of it, seeing clearly, sometimes not. So this idea of, okay, so this election has happened. I'm just saying any event has happened, and now let go of, you know, reactions to that or whatever. First of all, I think we need to recognize all the diluted thoughts that went into that attachment anyway, of not really looking clearly. Like I myself, I'll just say, it also awakened in me how I wasn't paying attention maybe to various things. So I guess it's just not to me. I just don't see it so simple as like, okay, one event. Yes. In one event, one moment, etc., going forth. But to see the whole ball of wax, too. That's all. We can just put that aside, then, because I see a puzzled look.
Well,
it's very complicated, because we're coming from a deluded mind to begin with, conditioned by tremendous attachment to, you know.
I'll see you, Frank.
Sorry.
Take care, Frank. Probably the Sangha is not a place for political discussions. The whole ball of wax is part of the first noble truth. That's all. I mean, that's the right view.
And you can still have a view and walk in a protest, but you're not burning anything or hurting anyone else. You're walking in a peaceful protest.
As with all things, what's your intention behind it? That's all. I mean, that's where the Eightfold Path guides us.
Right.
If my intention to protest is to show the world how wrong other people are, that's a self-referential view, and it's going to be hurtful to me and to other people.
Please, John, I have to leave early tonight.
I'm glad you made it. Please tell Judy I said hello. Well, I think we've had if you want to stay for Metta, we'll finish with Metta. Does anybody have anything burning to talk about? We've had a great discussion. A few quick announcements. There'll be no class next Tuesday. It's the Donna dinner, so I hope we'll see you all there. The next one-day retreat is December 4th, and the Truth of Happiness course starts on December 6th. Tomorrow's Dhamma stream class, if anybody was thinking about it, is postponed until Thursday. I have a funeral to attend to tomorrow. So let's finish with the Buddha's words on Metta. So close your eyes and close your mouth and become aware of the mindfulness of the sensation of breathing in your body. And let that mindfulness of your breath cease any distracting thoughts to the past or to the future or that may have arisen from our talk today, especially the politics. And Metta is both an aspiration for those of us on the Eightfold Path and an expression of an awakened, fully mature human being. And this is the Buddha's words on Metta. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful and interesting class. Peace. Thank you for listening. For more Dhamma talks and articles, please visit crossrivermeditation.com. We rely on donations from our listeners to provide these talks. If you have found this talk helpful in developing your understanding of the Dhamma, please consider a donation at crossrivermeditation.com. This talk is copyrighted and is made available under Creative Commons 4.0 license. Please visit crossrivermeditation.com for use and distribution information. Peace.